So welcome. This is a CSI Effect panel. We're going to get underway. We're hoping that Marcia Clark will be joining us, but we're not sure. So on the upside, we each get a microphone. So we're very happy about that. The name of the panel is the CSI Effect, and we're going to be discussing forensics both specifically and generally, and we are going to be discussing the CSI Effect itself, even though I don't know for sure that that's what was intended when the panel was titled, because sometimes the panel titles really don't have anything to do with what they're supposed to be about. But it's still a cool panel title, and if you look at the people sitting next to me, it's a cool panel. So I will give a brief introduction, and you guys can let me know if there's anything critically important that I've left out. I guess we'll start, ladies first, with Lisa Black, sitting to my left. Lisa says she has spent five of the happiest years of her life in a morgue. As a forensic scientist in the Cleveland coroner's office, working with all sorts of trace evidence and with crime scenes. Now she's a certified latent print examiner and a CSI for the Cape Coral Police Department. She's a New York Times bestseller, and her latest books are Defensive Wounds, which takes place right next door to here at the Ritz-Carlton, and Trail of Blood, Blunt Impact, comes out in April. And I've always wondered, if someone's a latent print examiner, is that just like they have the potential to it and they've always had an urge to, but they've never actually examined prints? Maybe not. So
technically, yeah, that's what it would mean. Yeah.
Sitting to my right is Jonathan Green, co-executive producer of Law & Order SVU and a writer of the show as well.
Former
writer, right, and now a novelist. He was nominated for an Edgar in 2004 for best teleplay, and his current novel is Kill Switch, which he's co-written with his writing partner Neil Baer. You guys have co-wrote together on Law and Order as well.
Yes.
Okay, great. And sitting at the end is Jim. J.I. Baker.
That was my publisher's idea, not mine.
Yeah. It's very distinguished.
Yeah, thank you.
And, you know, so, and I can, it's not a bad idea, because I can tell you for sure from Googling you that there's a lot of Jim Bakers out there.
I think they didn't want me to be confused with the defrocked priest.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
Yeah. Minister, sorry.
So it's Jim Baker with one K, right? Because he was a 2K
Baker,
right?
Yeah. And then there's the Secretary of State, so.
Yeah, that's right. We'll take that. That's not so bad. Jim's an executive editor of Condé Nast Traveler with a pretty extensive magazine background.
Yeah, that's my background as a journalist.
Yeah, and his new book is The Empty Glass, which is a thriller basically surrounding the life and death of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, it's a paranoid conspiracy thriller about the events that followed in the wake of the death of Marilyn Monroe in 1962. Excuse me, my voice is crackling.
I have a pocket full of lozenges. I'm going to put them out on the table just in case. I was remarking.
Actually, won't.
Yeah, go ahead. I was remarking earlier in the hospitality room. There does seem to be this process of natural selection, a very efficient process of natural selection in the candy bowl. That on the first day, everybody's eating the Twix bars and the Snickers. But you know, by day three, when all the good candy's gone, everybody's scrambling for those hard candies to soothe our battered throats. So I'm going to. I guess I'll kind of start with an explanation of what actually the CSI effect is, or what it's perceived to be, and then we can discuss a little at length about what that is or isn't, and how I'm wrong in my description. Who's got the?
I was thinking, are we going to have visual aids?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
What's he going to pull?
So I brought a severed head. I thought we could discuss. I was actually on a forensics panel here a couple years ago, and we brought crime scene photos to analyze. And I still have nightmares about those. I don't know how you actually do it, you who work in the field. So the CSI effect is a phrase that's been kind of bounced around for the last couple of years, and it has to do with the effect of the popularity of forensic shows like CSI, and I think also probably the popularity of forensic literature, and the effect it has on the public and law enforcement specifically. I think it, you know, we were just talking about a couple of different kind of perceptions of what that effect is. But so the question as I wrote it was, some view the CSI effect as a bias for the defense in actual criminal trials. An expectation among juries or the public that there should be reams of forensic evidence in any criminal trial, and anything less weakens the prosecution's case. So prosecutors complain that the burden of forensic evidence is higher now after these shows have been on the air for so long and have kind of really impacted the public perceptions. But others see it as a bias for the prosecution, with juries placing an absolute and often or sometimes unwarranted faith in forensic evidence that can sometimes be ambiguous or open to interpretation. So I'm going to start with Lisa. In your professional work, do you see this effect? Do you see evidence of this effect? And which of these do you think is more prevalent?
Well, I think they both are, depending on the circumstances and depending on what's presented at the trial. I think that the whole CSI effect just refers to the juries wanting this mountain of physical evidence, and the idea of placing perhaps a little too much faith in anyone with doctor before their name and silver hair and preferably male has always been around. And I think it's just human to want to see order and logic in everything. So that's not really that surprising.
Do you have any?
I mean, you know, and part of what we did certainly on SVU, and we use a lot of experts. We would be using experts like you, Lisa. And when we talk to the prosecutors, we do hear this. I mean, what you have prosecutors who will have a case that has no forensics at all, but they know who the suspect is. And they'll be, can everybody hear me okay? They'll be able to, they'll actually go into a trial, give their opening statements, and in their opening statements they're going to say, well, here's what you're not going to see. And you're not going to have fingerprints. You're not going to have DNA evidence. You're not going to have this. And the reason is because in some cases, there are none of this stuff, but that does not mean that the person who stands before you on trial is not guilty. The other thing, Lisa, you said that's really interesting is that the hand in hand with that is the issue of expert testimony and what you said about the fact that that anybody with the title doctor in front of them. I mean, you'll see that especially in cases of the defense. In fact, I'm looking at something right now for another piece of work that I'm doing where there was a forensic psychiatrist, not the character in my book, who appeared in a case involving a serial killer for the defense. And, of course, the prosecution comes up and asks questions like, Dr. So-and-so, how many of these kinds of trials have you testified in? And the doctor would say, like, maybe 80, and then the prosecutor would ask, and how many, and out of those cases, how many of those were for the defense? So in other words, there's the issue of, you know, how much, you know, it's kind of like how much testimony can you buy from experts who will, you know, who will look on your side. So that's what we've seen. And then the third thing I want to say is, and I just heard about this the other day, that in addition to the CSI effect, there's a new effect apparently that's going on these days called the 50 Shades of Grey effect. It's actually not a joke, but it sounds funny, but it's actually not a joke. And this is what you hear from sex crimes prosecutors saying they are having, since that book came out, they are having more trouble convicting sex offenders than ever before. I mean, I think I'm trying to remember the exact story, but they were talking about one case where it was a clear cut case of, say, date rape or something like that. And you know, you have a mostly, because I don't think there's any guys who've read that book, but mostly female jury.
And I think Gilbert Gottfried did.
Oh, okay. Yeah. that's Gilbert. The prosecutor said we got a not guilty verdict. They couldn't believe the jury did not believe that this woman did not want rough sex. So you have that sort of thing going on now too. So it's very interesting the effect that anything that we, those of us at this table who do what we do, has on the public at large.
Isn't there also my book takes place in 1962, so this becomes kind of irrelevant in a way. This didn't, obviously there was no CSI in 1962. But isn't also part of the problem or the issue the idea that people are so used to things being wrapped up really quickly and very simply without a lot of complexity, and they expect that, and when that natural everyday life complexity actually comes into the trial or whatever, they think that's somehow suspicious?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've heard that a lot, actually. And I don't know if that, I mean, is, I mean, I'm sorry, but that might be called the law and order effect.
Yeah. Could be.
I have also, you know, as someone who has written about forensics, who does not have the background that Lisa does, it's a very research heavy endeavor. You know, you have to do a lot of research in order to get it right, and you really do want to get it right. And I kind of flippantly, but I think it's true. There is another CSI effect that I've encountered in doing the research. When you're talking to the experts and you're really trying to hone in on a really accurate depiction, and time and again they'll say, "Come on, you've seen the show. You can just make stuff up." so that I actually wonder if you think that there is a kind of a different burden of veracity on television as opposed to literature. I mean, I think that people are, you know, or I'm wondering if people are more accepting of certain blurring lines of the truth or of accuracy in order to fit the constraints of a 60-minute show as opposed to a 400-page novel.
Well, exactly. I think it's all time. I mean, people, when you're watching a TV show, you know they have to do it in 60 minutes. So I think people are more forgiving because they know the reality is that you're going to have to gloss over a whole lot to fit it all into 60 minutes. But with a book, you don't have that constraint. So you can be more accurate in a book, so therefore you should be.
Have any of you ever been called on anything or had readers contact you kind of picking a point with your writing?
No, I've made mistakes.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone's ever argued with anything in particular, but I have made errors. I think in my very first book, I had a bullet going like 3,000 feet per second, and nobody caught it for like 4 years. And finally, some guy emailed me and said, "Are you sure?" He was very nice. He's like, "Are you sure? Because I don't think bullets can go that fast." I'm like, you know, I have no idea where I got that number.
It sounded good, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder also, you know, those of us who kind of come at it from a writing background, you know, without that professional experience of yours, one of the things that I found in doing the research is just how specialized the different forensic disciplines are. And I know that your experience is pretty broad. You've done, you know, you've done crime scene investigation, you've done latent prints, you've done trace analysis. But do you find when you're writing, do you find that you're having to do a decent amount of research as well, just in the disciplines that aren't your primary focus?
Oh, definitely, yeah. If it's not something I work with every day, I have to research it. I don't think I've ever yet had somebody killed by gunshot, just because I don't, you know, ballistics is just an overwhelmingly broad category to me, and nobody will jump on you like gun experts if you make a mistake, so I just avoid the whole thing by never having anyone actually shot.
That's interesting.
That's the way to do it.
So actually, I guess, Jonathan in particular, do you ever have people kind of calling you on inaccuracies or debating points?
Not on the science. We actually did a lot of research, and in fact, I just got off the phone with, we have a On SVU, we had a guy whose last job in the crime scene unit in the NYPD was actually going through the debris of the World Trade Center after 9/11. That's when he retired, and he had came to work for us after that. And we also used him. Neil and I also used him for the book that we did and the one that's coming out shortly. And we felt like, and we did this, surprisingly enough, the biggest complaint we got was from lawyers. You know, we don't talk like that in court. It's much more informal. The judges are usually acting like idiots. They're not like these paragons of justice. You don't bring a person to murder on a murder trial to trial in a week. But, you know, TV is, well, in 42 minutes we have to tell a story, and the biggest thing that we have to play with is time. So because we have to play with time, we try not to play with so much else. So when it comes to things like science and forensics, I mean, at least on our show, I won't speak for actual CSI, we really tried to, we use the experts, we use things that, new forensic techniques that we'd read about. Mm-hmm. We always tried to be as accurate as we could, and what we didn't know, we really tried to either research or had the people who are working for us research it.
Mm-hmm. In my forensic series, the D.H. Lovin books, and I'll mention that in a second. I did get called on one thing, and it was on the first, basically the first page after the prologue, the first page of chapter one of my first book, and someone had said, this rookie crime scene technician took the photos in concentrically closer circles instead of expanding circles. And I was like, damn, I was like, it's her first day on the job, cut her a break, So I was able to reply to that. Which reminds me of a question that hopefully the audience might be wondering, which is, who the hell am I? Because I did not introduce myself earlier. So my name is John McGoran. I have a non-forensic ecological thriller called Drift coming out in July from Tor Forge. But I've written as D.H. Dublin, and a series of three forensic thrillers set in Philadelphia featuring the character Madison Cross. So in case anybody was wondering, I thought I should put that out there. So I wanted to change the direction just for a second, because I know probably a lot of the people in the audience might be writers. And I do think that there are, when you're writing straight fiction as opposed to, if you're writing mysteries as opposed to straight fiction, there are certain kind of obligations that you're under and certain things that you have to take into account that you might not normally with straight fiction. And I think with forensic fiction, that is even more pronounced. So when I teach mystery writing, I talk about the challenges of outlining or plotting the solution of the puzzle that's at the center of the book. In addition, and almost separately, you have to bring them together. But apart from outlining the actual plot and the things that you would have to outline just as a story, in forensic mysteries, there's a further constraint in that the vast majority of the important information has to come from forensic sources. And there's often a technologically imposed lapse in time between when it's discovered and when the information that is contained in that evidence is revealed. So I'm wondering if each of you could share any tips or tricks or tribulations of constructing a plot, both mystery and more specifically forensically.
Well, in my case, I was dealing with a very real case, and it was something, so in that sense, I had an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage was I didn't really have to make a lot up. The disadvantage was I couldn't make a lot up. So I had, speaking of like time constraints, I had the death of Marilyn Monroe. I wove what happened to her, historically and factually together with a narrative about somebody I totally made up. But I was determined when I was writing the book not to cheat on any of the Marilyn stuff, to be as accurate as I possibly could about everything that happened to her, which meant I did not want to take liberties with time, like the day of her funeral, when the toxicology reports would come back. So that was tricky because, to your point, I had to have certain things happen with my hero, but they had to happen on her schedule. And I don't really have tips or tricks surrounding that because it's not a normal plot in the sense that I literally was constrained by that timetable, if that makes sense.
I can speak for both the book and for television. I mean, usually what in my experience has been is you come up with this story and then you try to find the forensics to fit your needs. In other words, I mean, if it can be something cutting edge, it's cutting edge. If it's not something terribly cutting edge, I can't remember any time that I've written anything, or even on SVU, we did anything where you actually had this neat new forensic kind of thing, and you actually fashioned a story, the entire story around that. Because most times, what we found is that the actual procedure, the procedure of the forensics. won't sustain a full story.
Right.
So for me, I mean, at least that in my experience, that's been more of a device and like, hey, wow, this is cool, or even just interesting forensic information about, for example, I mean, you talk about autopsies, things found in the bodies of the victims, and you think it's one thing, you think there's one issue, and it turns out to be something completely different. And that includes illnesses, stuff like, I mean, cancer and whatever, and who knows where any of these things came from. Environmental things that you find in somebody's body. I mean, that's always been a big thing. I mean, soil samples and all of this. Where has somebody been? Where has maybe the perp been? Is there something that you can tell in... For example, I remember on SVU we once did something. There was, like, some metal in somebody's... They tested, like, hair, which, of course, I'm pointing to my head and I have none. So I don't know what I was doing there. They tested a victim's hair, and they found out that this victim had been in a certain place at a certain time, and you can apparently tell that, and that helped us, you know, figure out who might have been there the same, that kind of thing. So I think I just rambled all over the place, but that's kind of where I go with that. Everywhere.
Well, my solution to dealing with time problems is just skip what's boring. Summarize what's boring. If it's not interesting, don't go into great detail. Just say she did this test, and in the next paragraph, you know, she's in someplace else, and don't spend a lot of time on it. And there's things I'll be unreal, you know, have her work only one case at a time, mm-hmm. even though that's completely unrealistic, and have her work overtime, which in Cuyahoga County, never. I mean, it wasn't even like overtime was a bad word. It was a non-existent word. So that never happened. But I'll fudge those details for a book. You know, I won't have her run an RFLP gel in 2 hours when it actually takes 17.
Right.
Of course, that's not relevant because nobody does RFLP anymore. But if they did, you know,
I was going to say that.
So there's, yeah. So there's things you'll fudge and there's things you can't fudge.
I had an experience. One of the most joyous discoveries that I had was I think it was in Blood Poison, which is the second novel. I needed to have a lag of time, and I didn't know exactly what the lag was, but I knew it was going to be substantial between when the fingerprints were discovered and when the identity came back. So I was trying to figure out how I could do that. And there's lots of ways, you know, you can kind of obscure them, but I kind of wanted to be cleverer than that. And I was researching, and I found that there was you might be familiar with this, or you might say, no, I never heard of that, John. What the hell are you talking about? Basically, it was a new software that had come out, and it was a company in Australia, and I talked to the manufacturer, the sales reps, and basically it was essentially an algorithm for separating out overlapping fingerprints. And I was like, well, how long, you know, what's the time frame on that? How long does that take? And I remember I almost cried. I was so happy because it was very late at night, and I was trying to get a lot of work done, talking to people in Australia. Basically, what they told me was that if the fingerprints were overlapping completely, you know, at the exact same angle, it could take weeks. If they were at 90-degree angle, it could take a couple hours. And basically, you could kind of, you know, like you could set it like a timer.
Just calibrate.
You know, just calibrate. Like, I think I need it to be about 6.5 days. You know, what angle would that be? And it was great. I rode that horse. I was very delighted with that. One of the things that has struck me, and we were talking about this earlier, is that, and I think that, you know, with the introduction of the CSI show and the forensic shows in particular, there really was kind of a we hit another notch in the tolerance of and the expectation, the acceptance of pretty extreme carnage in some cases, and I think we could, you know, talk at length and go on a tangent, which I'm not going to allow because I'm the moderator, about you know what effect that's had more broadly. But one of the things that I find kind of interesting is, you know, using reactions to that kind of compelling, stark, striking visual, that kind of impactful, you know, jarring carnage, as a lens to view character and to really reveal character through the different reactions that different characters have. there's the grizzled veteran cop who could be, you know, eating chocolate chip cookies while watching the bone saw. And then, you know, also the kind of the rookie who passes out or, you know, has to leave the room or whatever. But also just if there's anything in between, any of the kind of subtler implications or subtler revelations about character that any of you have used, using that technique.
One of the things that happened when I, it's a long story, because it was very difficult for me to research. On the one hand, it was really easy for me to research the book because all the details about what happened with Marilyn Monroe's autopsy, it's all a matter of record. You can look at the documents. It's been written about a lot. On the other hand, where it happened essentially no longer exists. It happened in the L.A. County coroner's office that at the time was in the basement of the Hall of Justice, which is a building that isn't used anymore. So it took me just forever to find anybody who knew anything about what that place looked like, how it functioned. And one of the guys that I talked to, sounds slightly tangential, but it actually isn't, said that he talked about what it was like to be a deputy coroner in that day and age and how basically they weren't licensed and it wasn't as stringent as it is now. And he said basically you just had to pass the walkthrough test to get the job. And I said, what's the walkthrough test? And he said, you had to walk through the place and not pass out. So, I put that in the book, and that does tell you something about a character. Like, I passed the walkthrough test, you use it as a joke, but it tells you it's somebody who's not totally freaked out by the whole thing.
A long time ago, I read a book about a detective. This is when I was a kid, literally, who could walk into the scene of a homicide and just... And I remember them describing him as somebody who, instead of reacting to the victim, was just able to see, like, he would go like this, and like this, and like this, and like this, and would be able to say, okay, and this guy was a chief of detectives, and he would say, okay, go do this, 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 and this. And they'd usually come up with somebody. And what it reminds me of now is that a lot of, when you become, when you are investigating murders, you can't walk into something and be, unless it's a kid, that breaks all the rules. You can't walk into a scene and be taken by. I mean, you could say, yeah. Wow, whatever happened here, level of violence. You know, unless it's a kid, and that again always disturbs everyone. But what's interesting is when you're working with live victims and things that happen to them and the ways that they're traumatized. And I think, you know, more than just gore and carnage. And there's also a visual versus. Let me do this first. Can I just put something out to the out to the group here? When as readers, when you read a book and you have these descriptions that we so gratuitously supply to you of what people do to each other, can you actually? How many of you can actually see that in your heads? Just out of curiosity. Okay. How many of those people? How many of you are disturbed by what you read? Okay. Now, when you see something like that depicted on television or even in the movies, how many of you are disturbed by it? Okay, interesting. I thought there would be more people. My reaction is that I can't necessarily see it so well when I read it in a book because it's something that I haven't seen much of in my real life. But when I see things like that in the movies or on television, it bothers me. Now, we don't show that much on TV, but when you go to a movie, I can't remember which one it was, but all I can remember were like just heads exploding when they were shot, and it really, those kinds of things bother me. So, right, exactly.
I don't watch them.
Yeah. So right, because you start to get disturbed by it. So I think I think it just really depends. I don't even know if this is answering the question. I think it really just depends on who you are and what you can envision as to whether or not. You're bothered by it. Is there an expectation to have it? I'm not really sure. Well, mm-hmm. You know, to have it in the books mm-hmm. and whatnot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I'm kind of schizophrenic on this issue because I will have and have stand there in the autopsy suite eating a bagel and drinking coffee while standing next to a pathologist sectioning a liver. Back in the days when you could do that, they don't let you take food into the autopsy suite anymore. They're really kind of, you know, stringent on that.
They don't let you take it out either, right?
But, you know, at the same time, like being a nurse in an emergency room or, you know, or a teacher or a bus driver would be like my nightmare job. If people are alive, I want nothing to do with them. They really stress me out, totally freaks me out. So, and there's, so I have to kind of force that on my character because I, you know, people think that's kind of cold to be perfectly fine with dead bodies. So I kind of almost have to make it up what she's feeling at a crime scene. But there have been, very rarely, but there have been a few times when that little wall, there's a crack in it and something happens, some case. It's usually children is very difficult for people, but I don't have children, so that's not really so, you know, so bad for me. That sounds cold too, but I mean there have been a few cases where just one little detail. Here in Cleveland, over in Shaker Heights or something, we had a 12-year-old girl shot by this older man who had a crush on her, and her poor parents had done everything they should do. They told the guy, stay away from our daughter. They got a restraining order. They called the police. They did, short of locking her in a closet for the rest of her life, they did everything they could do. And he walked up to her one day as she was walking to school and shot her point blank at the chest. And her two little friends that she was walking with were so traumatized they ran into the first storefront they found, which was a coffee shop where two cops were having breakfast. So they went out, and the guy was still sitting there with the gun. So it was a pretty open and shut case. But when I went through her clothing, she had this little glass bluebird that she was carrying around. And so things like I said, that very rarely happens. And I had another one last week that was kind of similar, which was an older woman. But I try and tap into that to try and remember what that's like when you have those one little moment where there's a crack in your wall.
I had in one of my books the you know character Madison Cross, who you know, the first book, it started with her first day on the job, and she came out of a medical school background and started working as, you know, just a junior forensic tech, you know, starting from the bottom. And one of the things that one of the character traits that I gave to her was that, you know, because of her medical background, seeing the body on the slab, seeing the body in the morgue, doing the autopsy didn't bother her, but when she was at the crime scene, it did, because it made it real life. And I kind of like that about her, that just that notion that it was different, that, you know, seeing the dead body in its natural habitat, it just disturbed the hell out of her, you know, because it really kind of breached that wall of separation that she was trying to maintain. Should we? I mean, I have a few more questions here, but should we keep going, or should we defer to the audience?
Take questions.
Sure.
Sure.
I'm just curious.
Oh, is there a personal error that drives me nuts? Yes, that a cop in, you know, like where I am, in little dinky Cape Coral, Florida, can put in a fingerprint and search everyone who's ever been fingerprinted in the United States, including job applicants and military. That even though that's been shown on TV for like the past 50 years, that has never been real. I can certainly not search job applicants. I cannot search military. Military is, you know, very careful of their records. But we are not networked in this vast national database. The FBI probably can, but they're the only ones. Although, very slowly, I mean, the technology is changing. And I am actually just this past week set up an account, this LEO account or something, that I may in the future have limited and restricted access to be able to search the FBI files. So just like anything else that has seemed like science fiction for the past 50 years, even though most people weren't aware of it, it was science fiction, probably will shortly be reality.
And actually, that and which, that bothers me.
You know, that and which, that bothers me too.
Sure.
I'd like to follow up on that question. They often come back and say it's a 100% match, and I had understood that with a fingerprint you come back with basically a list of potentials, and then a human has to go and compare them. Is that still true?
Exactly. Yes. when they show on TV on the computer a big banner that lights up and says match, that is not true. Computers do not match people, and that's true for DNA or ballistics or anything else. Computers do not match. They'll just bring up the best thing in their database that most closely approximates.
And for like eHarmony.com.
Yeah.
And can I just say that I didn't know that until I saw it on the first 48, for those of you who watch that on A&E. So.
Yes, a human being also... has to sit down. I have to sit down with the actual card and the actual 10 print from when they're arrested, and I do an manual eye-to-eye, what I call eye-to-eye comparison. And then I will pass it off to another examiner who will sit down with the two cards and their two glasses and their two pointers, and they'll go through the whole comparison again. So, no, it's not done by computer. And there's no such thing as 100% match. It either matches or it doesn't.
Right here.
A two-part question. One, what kind of CSI or forensic work is done in like a small town for Hosey? And secondly, you were talking about doing research. What are good books or reference sites for non-scientists to read to get better in forensic information?
Okay. Well, I'll take the first part and you two take the second part. In a small town, probably just fingerprints and toxicology, which would be drug testing. But every police department is different. That's another fallacy on TV. It's every crime lab is not just like every other. It can sometimes depend on your personnel and what the police chief takes an interest in and wants to shell out funding for. So, but your most basic police crime labs are just going to handle fingerprints and drug testing, and everything else may be sent to a state lab or a regional lab. So it all depends on how big your lab is.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, so my books are primarily set in Philadelphia, but each of them have at least some aspect of the book set outside the city, generally in a small town. And one of the things that was striking to me as I was researching that was just the almost unlimited variety of different kind of configurations, both of equipment and access to technology and dependency on other jurisdictions, especially for small towns, whether it's, you know, the borough using resources to the county, or, you know, the involvement of the state police, different, you know, sometimes they have kind of cooperative relationships with larger jurisdictions that they really don't have any kind of you know, they're not within the county, it's another borough, and they basically have a co-op that they share this larger jurisdiction's resources, probably for some, you know, some sort of a payback. One of the other things that was striking to me, and this is something I had down here, but we didn't really talk about. You know, there's a I definitely felt when I was writing that one of the things that is fun when you're writing about forensics is really kind of pushing the envelope a little bit, not from a believability standpoint or a reality standpoint, but just kind of seeing what's really on the cutting edge and what's on the horizon and what's coming out and learning about these new technologies and new techniques. And one of the things that you have to bear in mind is that nobody, you know, even you know, Los Angeles or New York or, you know, any of the largest departments in the country and that have the most up-to-date equipment, they don't have all the most up-to-date equipment. Because if they updated their equipment in January, you know, in August, it's not the most up-to-date. And especially when you're dealing with things like DNA analysis, stuff like that, where really the technology is just, you know, every 6 months there's new technology coming out. It's kind of interesting, and you have to kind of, you know, take your foot off the gas a little bit and say, okay, well, not everybody has everything, and you have to have, I mean, you don't have to, but I think it's good to have a realistic mix of the most up to date and maybe not so up to date technologies. Do you want to talk about the?
I was going to comment. You kind of went where I was going. Everything I've ever really written for publication or otherwise has taken place in New York because that's where I'm from. And what was interesting about this was, you talk about technology, I remember riding with, I rode with the cold case detectives out in Queens back in 96, and we went up to their squad room, and they were doing forms, and I saw them using carbon paper, and I couldn't remember the last time I'd actually seen a piece of carbon paper. You know, cut to Ray Kelly becoming commissioner, and then all of a sudden they have all this up-to-date stuff. In fact, the medical examiner's office in New York does have its own DNA lab. That's relatively new, and they do have most of the cutting-edge stuff, and they do keep up. And what's interesting about what's happened with the technology in New York is that when Kelly did become commissioner, and after 9/11, he basically redid the police department. And, I mean, New York City, believe it or not, was the last one to get even things like laptops in the police cars. So in New York, we kind of use the caveat, and this is what most people believe, too. I was just writing something about a character in a book that I read recently that went to another city to become a police officer because her police academy class was canceled in New York for budget reasons. And I was thinking to myself, who's going to believe that? That New York City would have to cancel anything for budget reasons. It actually did happen. So, but there is that believability, and what's really interesting, for example, is somebody talked about the there's never 100. Oh, you said, but there's never 100% match. What I was taught to do by this one forensics expert, who we've used for all these years, was not to say it's a match. You say it's consistent with, and that's how we have always tried. I mean, I was never able to do that on television because my boss at the time said, no, the audience wants to see that it's a match, so you got to make it a match. And we were the ones who had the red flashing light that said match. So.
Yes. Well, some things are matches and some things are just consistent.
Right.
With. Like
right.
Hairs and fibers, you can only say consistent with.
Right.
Fingerprint and ballistics, you can say, you know, DNA, you could say match.
Right.
So it depends. So.
And I think actually that instance, that notion of consistent as opposed to a match, I think that's one of the things we're getting back to the earlier point about the CSI effect. I think that's one of the places where it really manifests itself in criminal trials, that people put much more faith in something that is consistent, and they perceive it to be a match, and that's something that a more sophisticated understanding would kind of undermine.
I just wanted to get to your point about you're asking about web. Who just asked the question? I'm sorry. You asked about websites. I don't have. I don't have an answer specifically about, I don't know, websites in particular, but a long time ago I read an interview with the novelist Jeffrey Deaver, and he said that one of his sort of sources for his research was a book called Practical Homicide Investigation by Vernon Gerberth. So I went out, and it's really expensive. You can get it on Amazon.com. It's like $90 or something like that, but it's really an incredible book. It is not for the faint of heart, but it is really the manual that cops use or that they train with, at least my NYPD contacts and friends there. That's what they grew up using. It's kind of amazing, and then I later found out that Thomas Harris also used that and actually took, there's a really scary kind of case in it, I don't even want to say what it is, it's so disturbing, but he used that case in one of his books. Hmm. Practical Homicide Investigation by Vern, how do you pronounce it?
Vernon, I believe it's Gieberth, Gieberth.
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon.
They're very clean, they wash a lot. Yeah. Lint rollers. Yeah.
How are the criminals keeping up with this technology? Happily, most criminals are not very bright. So they do things like burglarize houses and not wear gloves. A lot are better than others. I mean, a few actually try. I think a case we had here, I don't remember if it was Angel Ormstead or one of those 16 and 17-year-olds over the years we've had killed by their boyfriends. And he had seen Pulp Fiction, where they try to clean the car, and he had had her body in the trunk, and he actually took a garden hose and filled up the trunk completely, three times with water, trying to wash it out. And it actually worked at that time with the DNA technology. They did not get DNA out of the trunk. So sometimes they try, but honestly, on the whole, you know, they're not smart enough to really keep up with it.
Yeah, in the back there?
Dr. Michael Bodden, who used to have a show Autopsy and does testifying, he was doing a seminar like this, and we asked him the same question about how are criminals keeping up with this, and he says, we're still catching them.
Yes.
They're not keeping up enough.
Yes.
So that's your consolation. As long as we catch them, there they are.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take, really, to get a DNA sample process?
I actually don't know. I haven't done DNA for years. But I believe because I asked somebody this just for my book when I was sitting in the witness waiting room to testify with a Florida Department of Law Enforcement DNA analyst. And I think it was about 2 days. If they totally cleared their desk of everything else, they might be able to do it in like 2 days.
And, that is one of those things that is such a moving target. It's been a couple of years since I wrote my last D.H. Dublin book. But one of the things that was, on the horizon, was presumed to be available in the not-too-distant future is accurate field tests. So really almost instantaneous results, which is one of those things that when you're trying to kind of include some of the most up-to-date technologies, and you don't want your, you know, the current technology that you're using in your book to be obsolete, is it's tricky. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is right now. So, you know, 2 days, but I do think in the not too distant future there will be, you know, almost real time.
Oh yeah, they're working on that.
Yeah.
But in order for DNA to be successful, you have to have the matched person in your files already, right?
You have to have
the database.
Or test the suspects if you can get a warrant for it.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, I wouldn't say it's systemic, but it happens. Like, you know, anything else, you're going to have weirdos and psychos that...
No checks and balances within the lab setting.
There usually are. They're supposed to be.
I come from a place called Nassau County on Long Island, and they literally shut down the crime lab there after they found out that whatever the protocols and procedures of normal forensic lab operation were not followed. And there are, I believe they're saying it could affect hundreds of convictions in Nassau County over a certain amount of time. And this wasn't faking. This was just incompetence and lack of oversight. Nobody watching, nobody minding the store kind of thing.
So I think we're just about out of time, but I think there's a book giveaway that's about to...
Yeah, if believe it or not, I'm probably even more disappointed than you that Marcia Clark did not show up. I had actually already inscribed a book I wanted to give her because I wanted to schmooze with her. So if anybody in the room is named Marcia,
yay,
you win a free book.
All right, I'd like to thank you all for coming out. It was a lot of fun having you. I'd like to thank the panelists.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.